Patriots, and I support Northampton's community radio station.
Sundays at 10 a.m., WXOJ's radio show, Occupy the Airwaves, has the latest news from the occupation movement, locally, regionally, nationally, and around the planet. Tune in at 103.3 FM or webcasting at www.valleyfreeradio.org, blogging at occupytheairwaves.wordpress.com. Listeners can call into the show at 413-585-1033.
Wednesday nights, you might tune in to the Warm Heart of Africa to hear the funky, sinuous rhythms of Afrobeat. Or the pulse of Algerian rhyme music. Or the desert trance of Tuareg blues. Or township jive from Johannesburg. Or catchy soukous beats from the Congo. Those are just a few examples of what you might hear from 7 to 9 every Wednesday night right here on Valley Free Radio. Join me, your host, DJ Vinyl Scratch, on the Warm Heart of Africa, a celebration of African and Afro-diaspora music, culture, and history, delivered with a groove.
You're here on Occupy the Airwaves at 103.3 WXOJ FM on Valley Free Radio. And we have a really interesting show today. We're continuing our conversation about Israel and Palestine. First, I'll let the hosts introduce themselves. I'm Una Doherty.
I'm Bob Gardner.
And I'm Kathy Daly.
And we have two great guests today from Smith Students for Justice in Palestine. And I will also let them introduce themselves.
I'm Clara Call.
Hi, I'm Miranda Hanrahan.
Welcome.
Welcome. We're really glad to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
So I understand there's an upcoming education opportunity at Smith for the entire community. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
All right. It's called Israeli Apartheid Week. So Israeli Apartheid Week is an international event. It's kind of a complicated week-month situation where from March to April, different colleges across the globe have their own, pick a week and have their own week. So ours is this coming week, and we have five events planned. The goal of the week is to raise awareness about Israeli apartheid and the consequences of it on the Palestinian people, the devastating impact on Palestinian life and human rights and culture. And we're also going to be building an anti-apartheid wall, which will be installed. It'll be about 18 feet long, 7 feet high. And we're installing it in front of the campus center of Smith College for a week. And we'd love for anyone to come and look at it. And we'll be drawing parallels between the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border and the militarization of the apartheid wall or the separation wall between Israel and Palestine.
So that's incredible. You guys have built an 18-foot-long, 7-foot-high wall that's to be installed at Smith. How long has it been taking you to work on that? How did you do it?
We've been working on the general, like, planning for the week for, like, I want to say, like, about 2 months.
Yeah. Planning's been going on for a while.
Yeah.
Planning of the wall design's also been going on for a while. We've had a bunch of meetings about it. The actual physical building couldn't start until we got funding approved, which meant that we could buy the materials. And there was a snafu with the paperwork on that the first time around. So we didn't have materials to start building until Friday morning. So 2 days. We've been building it for 2 days. And we're going to go back after this show and keep building it. And it'll be done by tonight.
Okay. And when is it being installed?
Tonight after sundown.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, it'll be up Monday morning.
And it'll be all the way until Sunday.
Yeah, we have a take down the wall vigil on Sunday evening at 7:15, where we're going to... Another member of the organization is organizing poems and testimonials from Palestinians to be read at the vigil, and there will be candles, and then... If we can get a hold of enough screwdrivers, we'll have like a group takedown of the wall.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Everyone will take down the wall together.
Exactly.
Fantastic. And could you tell us a bit more about the other events that are taking place next week? And
yeah, definitely. So one of the first events we have is a teach-in, which is called The Fight to Free Palestine. And we're doing that with Jewish Voice for Peace. Another teach-in we have on Wednesday is
that one's at 4:30 p.m. on Monday in the Smith Campus Center in room 103.
That is where it is. And then Wednesday at 7:30, also in the Smith Campus Center, we have a teach-in that we're co-sponsoring with another organization on campus called Smith Students for Food Justice, which is about food justice in Palestine. We'll be talking about agricultural boycotts and land rights and water access and all of that. And then our keynote speaker is Remy Kanazi. Who's coming?
Yeah. So the second teach-in is food justice, which is on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we have our keynote speaker in an event called Rising Up, a night of activism and poetry with Remy Kanazi, where we're inviting Palestinian American poet Remy Kanazi to come from Brooklyn, where he's based, to read his poetry about occupation and resistance. And we're going to open that event with students reading their own political poetry, and then there will be a question and answer and a book signing. And that will be in Graham Auditorium in Hillier. So Hillier is the art museum at Smith College.
Right.
And then if you like hidden somewhere inside it is this very nice auditorium that you have to kind of hunt for called Graham Auditorium.
It's in the basement.
It's in the basement where we keep all the things at Smith. And that's at 7 p.m. on Thursday, April 6th. And it's going to be a beautiful event.
Yeah. It sounds well worth searching for Graham Hall. Can you just give us is there a website where there's people can look up and get reminded about the locations and times of these events?
Yes, absolutely. So they all have their own Facebook events. We do everything through Facebook. If you go on the Facebook page for Smith Students for Justice in Palestine, you will find our events are listed. And there's one event that's just called Israeli Apartheid Week that lists everything, the dates and times for everything, and has a link to the individual more detailed descriptions of each event within the week.
Okay, and for the people who aren't great, you just go to your little window in Facebook and type in Smith Students for Justice.
Yeah, it should be the first thing that shows up.
Yeah, Smith Students for Justice in Palestine.
Okay, and it'll pop up. Great.
I have a few questions. Well, one, I always like to have guests take us back to sort of the basics. So it's not assuming that listeners know anything, or maybe not nearly as much as you two would know, or people in this room, about like why would you call it apartheid, and why is it called apartheid? And someone might be confused and say, "Well, wasn't that a South African term and movement?" And so, maybe make that connection a little bit for people.
Yeah, absolutely, Claire. You can jump in any time. But so the word apartheid was initially coined in reference to a series of South African racially codified laws. That is true. Literally, in Afrikaans, apartheid means separateness. So when we're talking about apartheid, conversations about apartheid and segregation are very closely linked. That said, apartheid does... excuse me. Apartheid does have a internationally, a codified description in international law. There is a legal definition of apartheid for the world, and it is divided into three pillars. The first pillar is the establishment of a codified state. State codifies into law a preferred identity, which in the case of South Africa was whiteness. In the case of Israel-Palestine, we're talking about a Jewish citizen of Israel. And if we want to get more detailed, we're really talking about a white-skinned Jewish citizen of Israel. But that's less codified into law. And the second pillar is that there's a set of laws that create, that alter, laws that apply differently to people who have that preferred identity and people who don't have that preferred identity, that discriminate against people who do not have it, that it is preferable to have that identity. It is, you are more treated with more respect by the law. And the third pillar of apartheid is policies created by the state, laws passed by the state under the name of security that are designed to and act to suppress all opposition to the regime. All three of those pillars apply very clearly to Israel.
Mm-hmm. I'm really learning things I didn't know here about international law and definitions. Thanks.
Yeah.
While we were talking about basics, I think that some listeners may not have even a basic idea of the geography or of the different names that I'm going to call it Palestine, because to me there's an area there that is Palestine and should be called Palestine. But I think people aren't quite sure of the geography or of all the different names that apply to the area Palestine. I'm checking with you, some of the words used to refer to Palestine are the occupied territories, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And geographically, where is the area where the Palestinian people right now mostly live? Where is that and what names does it have?
Well, a great number of the Palestinian people are in diaspora. So it's important to be aware when we talk about Palestine and the Palestinian people that a huge number of Palestinians are actually living in refugee camps around the borders mm-hmm. of Israel and Palestine because they've been forced out. So they're now living in refugee camps mm-hmm. in Lebanon and Jordan. But the two areas that we talk about as the occupied territories, the Palestinian territories, are the West Bank, which, just for added confusion, is actually on the east side of Palestine, or the east side of the entity that is Israel and Palestine. That's the West Bank. And then further to the west, we have the Gaza Strip.
And that's right on the sea, on the Red Sea?
No, it's the Mediterranean, okay. I think.
Yes.
Displaying my geographical ignorance, so nobody listening has to feel bad. Okay. So, Who runs Palestine, or we could call it the West Bank, now? What is the government structure for that area right now, the governmental and judicial structure?
So that's a complicated question. There's something called the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority is the government that is recognized by Israel. So it is the only institution that has any clout for negotiating on behalf of the Palestinian people with the Israeli government. But it is also has that power because it is granted that power by Israel. So its loyalties are very complex. It is tied to Israel inextricably. The Palestinian Authority is a very complicated entity that is considered by the United States, for example, to be the organization, the entity that speaks for the Palestinian people. But it's beholden to Israel in certain incontrovertible ways, because if it defies Israel too far, Israel will remove its support and it will be, it will have no power.
I want to remind everyone, we're talking to Miranda Hanrahan and Clara Cole of the Smith College Students for Justice in Palestine. And let's continue.
I'm wondering what's the legal system in Palestine or the West Bank? What is that like? Who administers it? I mean, if you know, if you don't know, never mind. You know.
I don't think we have a comprehensive answer to the legal system.
I think it's very complicated, and I don't think that
okay.
there's, yeah.
And again, sort of going back to basic, who are the settlers? What's that? I mean, my understanding is that there are Israeli people who are moving into the West Bank, and
So I mean, there are. This is complicated, but there are basically there are illegal settlements and sometimes legal settlements. Sometimes they're retroactively legalized. Sometimes they're legalized beforehand.
And the question of legality is complicated because we're both talking about Israeli law and international law.
Yeah, so it's very complicated as to whether or not they're legal. I believe the Israeli government just approved the first settlement for the first time in 20 years, excuse me, about 3 days ago.
I think it was a month ago.
No, it was like 3 days ago.
Wow.
Yeah. It was very, very recently.
Post-Trump.
Yeah.
Post-Trump. Right.
Now, where was this? In the West Bank, there was an approved settlement.
For the first time
in 20 years.
But there have been funded settlements by the Israeli government ongoing nonstop, right? Ever since, even after they agreed, the Israeli government agreed in various treaty agreements to stop building, they never stopped the moment, right?
So what tends to happen is that Israeli citizens build settlements, move into a Palestinian area and build settlements. The Israeli government says, oh, we didn't tell them to do that. And then moves in. But then they say, we have to protect our people now. They're mm-hmm. there. So they move in with tanks and bulldozers and guns and tear gas. And they force the Palestinian people out.
Are these in the settlements mostly in the West Bank?
Yeah, we're talking mostly about the West Bank. The Gaza Strip gets a lot of bombing, but they don't get a lot of settlements.
And
yeah.
East Jerusalem, I believe, has a whole
yes.
settlement movement there,
yeah.
too,
yes.
which is the Palestinian side of Jerusalem.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. So it's so what will happen is Israel will retroactively declare settlements legal
mm-hmm.
and will move to protect, and I'm putting that in quotes, they will move to protect settlements that have already been created by Israeli citizens who officially are acting without the backing of the Israeli government, but are doing so with the knowledge that Israel will come to support them in moving out Palestinian people.
And so that's kind of where the like heavy militarization comes in.
And of course, the land that this is being built on is Palestinian land legally, right? And then Israeli settlers come in and take land. Is that how? And so there's sort of like a extra legal movement going on too, even under Israeli law. But all the settlements, I think, are violations of various UN agreements in terms of building. They're all legal, no matter what the
yes.
Israeli government says.
All of the settlements are illegal under international law.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are illegal under official Israeli law. All of them are protected by the Israeli military. So the question of Israeli law becomes more opaque and complex when the military is present.
It's confusing to me that it's possible to build a big apartment complex or a residence without the support of the government. I mean, you can't even put in a new septic system usually, you know, let alone take a large piece of land, at least. In most countries, you can't build anything, so I don't understand how it is that this is happening, that these buildings are being constructed. And
that's an interesting question, and we're reaching the limits of my knowledge here.
Yeah, I mean, mine as well. I think, like, fundamentally, it's settler colonialism. And so like Miranda said, the settlements are being built with the knowledge that they will be protected by the Israeli government.
Mm-hmm.
So while the Israeli government isn't explicitly condoning them to begin with, it's not like they're doing much to prevent them.
But it is also true that the Israeli government does build its own settlements, and
mm-hmm.
it's true that they did just approve
yeah.
this new settlement in the West Bank. Sorry.
Could you talk a little bit and tell me about the wall. You know, not your wall, although I love hearing about your wall, but the wall that's actually there in between
yeah.
the West Bank or Palestine and Israel.
We have a lot to say on the wall. The wall. So the first thing that we need to know about the separation wall is that it is built on Palestinian land.
Mm-hmm.
The separation wall was created with the rhetoric that it was going to protect Israeli citizens from attacks by Palestinians on Israeli land. And it was, and the Israeli land that it is protecting includes many illegal settlements, illegal under international law, built on what is codified in the United Nations as belonging to the Palestinian people. That now, not only do Palestinian people not get to live on, they physically can't access it because there's a wall.
The wall, yeah, I mean, the wall oftentimes, it's about 440 miles long. And about 85% of the wall cuts very, very deeply into Palestinian land. So the idea of the wall was, again, like Miranda said, like to protect Israeli citizens, including illegal settlements. But the effect of the wall is that it cuts very deeply into Palestinian land and further enforces like settler colonialism and denying Palestinian land rights.
And we're talking in a context where the Israeli government on a regular basis bombs hospitals and other infrastructure in the Gaza Strip.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're talking about, and is constantly evicting people from their homes. So we're talking about a disenfranchised, impoverished people who almost all functioning hospitals, education, employment opportunities are in what is considered by Israeli government to be Israel, behind the wall. Palestinians can't get there without passing through approval by Israel.
Checkpoints, right?
Through the checkpoints. The checkpoints are a whole
it's a whole thing.
And you know, there's horrible stories. Women give birth at these checkpoints.
Yeah, so I mean, on average, it'll take probably like 3 to 4 hours to pass through a checkpoint, which is not, you know, it might only be like a few miles away. It might be like a 30-minute drive, but because you have to get through the checkpoint, it turns into a 4-hour drive.
Right. So that's if you work in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and if you work in Israel and you're trying to get there, that's 4 hours both ways every day, and you're harassed at the checkpoint. You're subjected to racism at the checkpoint, and it's important to, in the context of. And this is part of what the wall we're building is about, mm-hmm. is militarizing borders because you're afraid of the people on the other side is something we've seen again and again through history. And it's never like a good plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's never just. It's never for just reasons. The Palestinian, this is important to be aware of. Palestine doesn't have an army. Palestine doesn't have a military, can't have a military, doesn't have the resources for a military, doesn't have legal recognition by the UN as a country, so it legally can't have a military. Israel is not under siege by Palestine. Palestine is under siege by Israel. So the idea that they're going to build a wall that's going to protect them from Palestine is really just rhetoric based purely on racialized fear. It's rhetoric based on the visceral fear that is cultivated by Israeli propaganda that the largely Muslim Arabic population of Palestine is frightening and dangerous and can't be allowed near us. And so they take these extreme military measures that destroy Palestinian lives. The wall slices through Palestinian villages. It mm-hmm. separates Palestinian communities and families. Its impacts on the Palestinian people and culture are devastating and uncountable. And it's all based on this rhetoric of, oh, we're afraid of them.
All
right. I have a few more questions. One was actually a call-in a little while ago, and I could start with that, which is just asking for a comment on Trump's stated policy in Israel and Palestine, including switching the capital or embassy to Jerusalem and the U.S. ambassador. How's that for a question?
So I mean, obviously, we very much oppose the employment of David Friedman. I know personally, I did a lot of work around that and calling my senators, and we're not happy about that. And we also do not support moving the the embassy. I know that every time there's a new president, they always have the option to move the embassy. And every president has said, up to this point, it's been like, no, like I wouldn't even consider it. And so it's very scary for us. Not so much for us, but we're very concerned about it.
Could you review what's happened with the moving of the embassy? I didn't catch like what's actually happened, where it was before, and
well, it's Tel Aviv, as it is with mm-hmm. all other countries, and it's Israel issue that they want to have all of Jerusalem be the capital of Israel. But what had happened with the establishment of Israel, my understanding is it's supposed to be an international city and should never be taken over by any one entity. So it sort of flies in the face again of UN mandates. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the long-term Israeli plan is to totally control Jerusalem, you know, and be not have a Palestinian.
So the boundary line at this point goes through, there's a boundary line through Jerusalem, and West Jerusalem is Israel's and East Jerusalem is Palestine's. Is that roughly how it works point?
But again, there's a settler movement moving into taking
continual encroachment on the Palestinian area of Jerusalem.
So one of the things that this also does, which Students for Justice in Palestine is a Palestinian solidarity group. So we don't aim to tell the Palestinian people like what to do or how to solve this problem. We believe in their self-determination. But one of the things that the potential act of moving the embassy to Jerusalem does is really jeopardize the two-state solution, which
some consternation here.
So I'm not at all saying that Students for Justice in Palestine is condoning the two-state solution. Like, that's what we're advocating for. But what I'm saying is that that is why there's been a lot of pushback from a lot of organizations in the United States, because the two-state solution is a solution that a lot of organizations advocate for, not Students for Justice in Palestine.
I would... Thank you. I agree with you. I would phrase it differently. I would say that to move the embassy to Jerusalem jeopardizes the possibility of an autonomous, democratic Palestinian state.
Yes.
Which both things are true. Both things are true. But and it's only because two-state solution is a term that came out of the United States. It's not a term created by the Palestinian people. And we're here to support the Palestinian people in their struggle for liberation and everything that Claire already said. But to move the capital to Jerusalem means that the United States is officially condoning Israel's occupation of Jerusalem. It establishes Jerusalem as a city that legally belongs to Israel. Because of the symbolic relevance of Jerusalem, it also implies an acceptance that all of this land actually belongs to Israel.
It makes Jerusalem look like the capital of Israel.
Exactly.
Basically, right?
Right.
Are there checkpoints through Jerusalem in between East and West Jerusalem? I'm just curious.
I don't know.
I'm actually unsure.
I think the vast majority of the checkpoints are actually inside of the Palestinian-occupied territories.
Yeah.
Are actually to prevent Palestinian freedom of movement within their own territories.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're established under the pretense of preventing Palestinians from going into Israel unauthorized, they're actually to prevent Palestinians from...
This is probably Paki calling in.
I think we have Paki calling in from Washington.
So I'm going to do a station ID while we have her on the line. And you're listening to Occupy the Airwaves. Broadcast live every Sunday at 10 a.m. on WXOJLP 103.3 on your FM dial in Northampton, Massachusetts. You can listen to us live on the radio every Sunday at 10 a.m., or you can stream this show live at valleyfreeradio.org. And you can hear a rebroadcast of this show again every Thursday at 4 p.m. We have a Facebook page at Occupy the Airwaves. And we have a Facebook page at Occupy the Airwaves 2.0, and we have a blog at occupytheairwaves.wordpress.com. Now, I don't think this is Paki.
No, it's not. This is Johanna with a question for our guest, I believe. Johanna, can you hear me?
And yes.
Okay.
Yes, can
Hi,
you
Johanna.
Hear me?
Yep, you're sounding fine.
Here's my question. I'm not in any way condoning what Israel is doing, but I'm wondering if there's a way you can talk about, or if you have any understanding of why Israel is reacting this way. You said racial fear, a sense of anybody who thinks about Jewish history has some sense of where that comes from, but trying to understand why Israel is reacting this way. End of question. Go for it.
Thanks, Johanna.
I think it's a very important question. I think that I hear what you're saying about Jewish history, and I understand that you're referring to the global historic oppression and genocide against Jewish people. And I feel like what you're implying is that there's a legitimacy to Jewish fear of that kind of violence from the people around them because it has happened so often to them in the past. What's important to be aware of is that that violence didn't come from the Middle East. That violence came from Europe. And Europe was actually, and the United States, and that, and Russia, and a lot of other people. But it didn't come from the Middle East. You know, to talk about anti-Semitism in the Middle East, you have to remember that the people in the Middle East are Semitic. They are descended from the same people as the Jewish diaspora. So the, so that violence never came from the Middle East. The fear of discrimination and genocide from the Middle East isn't based on historical fact. What is happening is that Israel is in fact a settler colonial state. Israel was established as a state on land that already belonged to other people. So the real, so while Israel does deliberately manipulate the existing and valid fear of Jewish people that there will be violence against them, they actively work to manipulate that fear. What's actually happening is that the real existential fear of Israel is based on the fact that they're a settler colonial state. They're on land that they took, and the people that they took it from want it back. So it's the same existential fear that the United States has against the indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same, the Indian Wars of the United States, the famous quote, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. That is the kind of rhetoric and hatred that we're talking about. It's the fear of a settler colonial state against an indigenous people.
There was a follow-up comment from Johanna that's saying that she doesn't condone what's gone on at all, but just trying to get a deeper understanding of and feeling like they just get that issue and question out there.
But, yeah, absolutely. And, thank you.
And we distinguish between, I'm sure, between more Zionist and right-wing elements of the Israeli government and many, many Jewish people and Israeli people who are also deeply concerned about what's happening to the Palestinians in their own country.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And the equation of, and it's an important point, the equation of Judaism with Zionism is also itself an Israeli construct. Many Zionists are not Jews. Many Jews are not Zionists. Many Jews have criticisms of the Israeli government. So the idea that to criticize Israel is to criticize Judaism is something that is, or the idea that Israel and Judaism are the same is an idea constructed by and perpetuated by Israel.
And I want to remind everyone we're listening to Miranda Hanrahan and Clara Call of Smith's College Students for Justice in Palestine. And Pocky Whalen will be calling in soon from the AIPAC convention in D.C. So we're hoping you'll stay and maybe have a little conversation with her.
I know there was some mention of the two-state solution, and, you know, I don't know if anyone wants to hear my opinion. To me, that doesn't sound too bad, a Palestine and an Israel. People have opinions all over the map on that, but I'm just wondering, is there anybody who thinks there should be a one-state solution that is only Israel? I'm just curious. Does anyone advocate that?
Yeah, Israel.
There are definitely people who advocate for that.
I think an important quote that I was on the news this morning. So with regard to the new settlement that Israel has just declared that they want to put in Palestinian occupied territories in the West Bank, the education minister of the current Israeli administration has said, and I'm going to quote as best I can, I might misplace a the, We are seeking that this settlement will help to further Israeli dominion or Israeli control over Judea and Samaria. Judea and Samaria is the biblical term for the West Bank. So Israel is articulating its desire to completely control the West Bank, which is one of the only pieces of land that Palestine has left.
Can I interrupt here to say we have Paki joining the discussion from Washington, D.C. Paki, can you hear us?
Yes, hi. I've been listening to the program this morning, and first of all, I just want to thank Claire and Miranda for being with us, and also just to say how happy I am that there is a Students for Justice in Palestine that's so active on the campus. It's really thrilling to hear that. And I'm sorry to miss seeing your beautiful wall put up.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
We can send pictures, maybe.
We'll be putting pictures all over our Facebook page. So if you want to look us up on Smith Students for Justice in Palestine on Facebook.
I looked you up this morning, but when you get those pictures up, I'll be happy to see them.
All right, thank you.
Let me just give you a little update on what happened last week at AIPAC. It was very exciting because there were so many different groups. There was If Not Now, which is a Jewish group that's opposing the AIPAC's, all of AIPAC's behavior, and so they were very, very powerful. Jewish Voices for Peace was there, as well as a number of Palestinian groups, and Answer Code Pink was there. A number of people were there decrying the power that the United States government has given to this AIPAC, which is the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee. And in and of itself, it's really an extra legal organization. They're a lobbying group that's lobbying for a foreign country, and they're not so registered. So there's some of those legal questions. But I just want to point this out because there's that famous quote, you know, one person's death is a tragedy, and a thousand people's deaths is a statistic. And I just want to acknowledge someone. Last week, Kamal Nafe, who is a Palestinian, was brutally attacked by members of the Jewish Defense League. The Jewish Defense League had never been at one of the AIPACs before, to my knowledge, and I've been to many of them over the past 5 or 6 years. And they, too, are an organization that has been listed by the United States government as a terrorist group. And they brutally beat this man until the police interfered. And he was subsequently hospitalized. And he's going to be all right. But this was some of the behavior, the thuggery that this current administration seems to not only condone but encourage. So, but most of the protests were nonviolent, and they were in the same vein as what you Students for Justice in Palestine are doing. They're nonviolently protesting something that is really criminal. And I really appreciate your noting the similarities between what these European settlers did on this continent, which natives refer to often as their home, the Turtle Island, and what the Israelis have done, what the settlers have done, and not settlers simply those living in settlements, but when the United States and Britain and France said, the Jewish people need a place, let's give them that famous quote, a land without people for a people without land. They totally disregarded the Palestinian people who had lived there with Jews, with other people, for centuries. Right. And by diminishing them, it was the same kind of thing that doctrine of discovery was about Europeans coming to this continent. That is fortunately now really being challenged. And I think when you all started the program talking about Israel being an apartheid state, I think it's very important to note that and to see how it's operationalized. You talked about how you know the way Palestinians just trying to go to work have to go through so many hurdles. You talked about the walls, and the walls are so interesting in that they are so brutally just terrible, in that you could have a home and a garden, and the Israeli government could put a wall between your house and your garden. You know, there's a total disregard for human rights, and I think when student groups particularly stand up and educate yourselves about what's happening in a place you can stand for justice, I am so heartened.
And while we're talking about educating ourselves, I think it might be a good idea for just for Miranda and Clara to repeat that about next week. It's Israeli Apartheid Week, and just to cover again a couple of the events briefly.
Yeah, so next week is Israeli Apartheid Week, and we're going to have a variety of events, including a teach-in with Jewish Voice for Peace Monday at 4:30 in the CC.
That's the campus center.
The campus center, yeah. Sorry, excuse me. Another teach-in Wednesday night at 7:30, which will be talking about food justice in Palestine, which will be at 7:30 also in the campus center. Our keynote speaker, Remy Kanazi, is coming on Thursday at 7:30.
At 7.
Sorry, excuse me, in Graham Hall, which is in the basement of the Hillier Art Museum. And Friday night, we have a screening of Five Broken Cameras at 7 p.m. in Nielsen Library in the browsing room.
And I'm assuming these are open to the community?
These are all open
yes,
to the community.
Everything's free
they
and
all
open
free.
To the public.
We would love to have as many people from the public as we can. We think it's really important for activism to be rooted in the community that it's located in and not just be a college event. I want to talk a little bit about the first teach-in, which is Monday at 4:30 in the campus center, which is the Jewish Voice for Peace will be coming to talk about the principal arguments on the Zionist side and the anti-imperialist side of this conversation. So that's a really good intro point for somebody who's new to this conversation. On Thursday, Remy Kanazi, that will be a night of poetry, of activist poetry, and I think it's going to be a really beautiful event, and we would love for as many of you to come as can. And then there's a screening on Friday, and then on Sunday we are having a Take Down the Wall vigil where we're going to hear testimonies and poems and then actually physically deconstruct the wall together. So we'd love to have people come to that as well. The anti-apartheid wall, which also talks about U.S. border militarization, will be physically outside of the Smith Campus Center for the entirety of Apartheid Week.
And one more time, if people want to look up these events, they can go to the Smith Students for Justice in Palestine Facebook page.
Yes, and they'll be listed as events. If you go to Smith Students for Justice in Palestine Facebook page, you go to our events, they'll all be listed there.
Okay.
I have a few. Oh, sorry. I just want to applaud you for the work you're doing because in today's world, it seems like everything is polarized, but nothing is more polarized than what you're dealing with. And so I sort of had a question about like the blowback because I know not being deeply involved in it, there's always a huge amount of blowback with taking stands on these issues. So, you know, it's tremendous you are, but I'd like to hear about, like, what kind of pressure you're facing in taking these stands, if you can talk about it.
Yeah, so, I mean, like you said, it's a deeply controversial issue, and I think, as far as I know, Miranda, correct me if I'm wrong, because I am new to the organization, we have not received a lot of opposition from the administration.
Yeah,
the Smith College administration. We have received blowback from students, but it's been very underground, on mostly on anonymous forums, overheard
yeah.
conversations, things like that. But then again, we are going into the week, so nothing. You know, we haven't started yet. The wall isn't up, so we will
Let's
take
see
it as it
comes.
What happens.
The other thing, though, to note is that we can pretty safely assume that we're all under surveillance. So there was one scary thing that happened at the beginning of this semester where a lot of the members of our organization come from Jewish Zionist families, and they don't tell their families what they're doing because it is such a controversial issue. And one of our members received a text from her sister that said, "Why are you in Students for Justice in Palestine?" She had never told her sister. And we weren't, she tried to get her sister to tell her how she'd found out. And what we're pretty sure happened is that there are these organizations that actually I'm not going to list the websites because I don't want you to do it. But there's organizations, there's websites where you can go on. And a lot of them are run by the Israeli government, actually. But some of them aren't. You can go on and you can report any Palestine organizing that's happening on your campus. And then that will be listed in a database. And then people can access that database. And it's used to target people. Mm-hmm. This is going to wreck all of our careers later on. And we know that going in. There are people in our organization who are international students and who regularly joke, but there's seriousness behind the joke. They regularly joke about, "Oh, I'm going to get deported today." Every time we host an event, every time someone walks, every time one of our members who's an international student walks around the campus with a keffiyeh, which is a scarf that's a symbol of Palestinian solidarity, she jokes, "Oh yeah, I'm going to get deported today." And so that fear is present, and we deal with it and we joke about it, but it's there.
Is Pocky still here?
Pocky, I'm still
here. On the line?
Yes, still here.
I want to direct these students' attention to Pocky Whalen, who has made a career of not having a career because...
That's true. Yeah, that's the plan. That's the plan.
Well, I think there's some things that are important, and I really appreciate your noting that there are organizations that do track people who are involved in anti-Israeli criminal behavior, and I think it's really important to note that so many times I think the Israeli people, both the Jews and Palestinians and others who live there, are really the pawns of corporations and of the people who are true believers and don't want to look beyond their own suffering. And one of the things that I've been really impressed with is the Jewish Voices for Peace people I'm working with here in D.C. and how inclusive they are in their writing of the Seder this year. It's so moving that it is so compassionate toward the Palestinians, and I think that's the best of any of our religions. And so, in contrast to the people who are using religion as a tool to stifle dissent, to stifle freedom, to oppress other people, I just want to give them a shout out. But you know, the other thing, Kathy, that I think is important to note is that I've had work. I'm retired, so I have a freedom that a lot of people don't. You know, when students who will be accumulating great debt may be blacklisted or denied jobs because of their student activities. I think it's really a call for all of us to stand with them and to stand behind our Bill of Rights, you know, that allows us to have freedom of speech and to keep using it as the students are doing at Smith's this coming week. To keep exercising it and to challenge when we are held in disregard for just being good citizens. So I think it is wonderful to have students who are willing to take risks and for us to also stand with them, just as many of us white folks are standing with the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, that this is a time that we really look at how all of the oppressions are rooted in the same things, and how whenever we're standing against them, wherever, that we need to keep standing together. And so Students for Justice in Palestine, we have your back.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I think you bring up important points. I think solidarity is really important. I just want to, you know, you mentioned, since we're talking about the consequences of activism, I do want to direct our attention for a moment to the Palestinian people, who the consequences of organizing in Palestine are so much more severe, are incalculably more severe. People are, I mean, you have your basic brutality against protest. And this is what we talked about. When we talk about apartheid, we're talking about one of the three pillars of apartheid is security measures that act to suppress opposition. So we're talking about massive tear gassing of peaceful protests. We're talking about military officers firing with real bullets into crowds of peaceful protesters. We're talking about the continual demonization of people, of children. So stone throwing, children throwing stones at a tank in Palestine is something that that child can be arrested, charged for, and convicted of, and punished for with jail time. And sometimes jail time in Israel includes torture. And recently there was we had this one statistic, and I can't remember the number, but there has been, I think, one acquittal of the in recent years of children who are charged with stone throwing are consistently found guilty and are consistently punished for it. And people who organizing in Palestine, organizing in Israel is functionally illegal, and the repression from the Israeli government is so severe that really it is our responsibility. It is our responsibility as American citizens, or even if you are not an American citizen, if you're paying taxes to the United States government, your money is going towards funding the apartheid regime. And so it is our responsibility to stand with the Palestinian people. And the risks that we incur are significant, but they are so much smaller than the life-threatening violence perpetrated against Palestinian activists.
Hear, hear. Well said. Yes.
So we do have to wrap up. We have to be out of here by 5 of. So, last comments. Claire, do you have any last word on?
thank you for having us so much. And we're really excited and honored to be here. And I think that I hope that I, like, speak for the whole organization when I say that we hope you all come out to Israeli Apartheid Week. Attend as many events as possible. We spent a lot of time working on it, and we're really, really excited about it.
Yeah. Come look at our wall. It's really cool, guys.
I want to help take it down.
Yeah.
Okay. Paki, do you have any last words?
I just want to thank the Occupy producers for this great show, and to the students, to Claire and
to Miranda,
to Claire and Miranda for being there, and to all the Students for Justice in Palestine, and thanks for having me on with you. Bye bye.
Thanks, Paki.
Thank you so much, everybody.
You've been listening to Occupy the Airwaves on Valley Free Radio,
and we're going to go out with some music that Bob's going to bring up underneath me here, and it's Psalms 104, some ancient traditional Jewish Babylonian composition. The arrangement is by Miani Dior.